Well, I've titled this message, Being Called to Serve. And yes, we're thinking about deacons, but as we've reminded ourselves, even about elders, actually all of us are called to serve, and it's not unique. So we're considering the role to be played by elders and deacons in the church. We've looked at how and why elders are to function, but crucially, I did try to point out last week that there isn't really anything that an elder is to do that all church members should not be doing. The only real difference is that elders function in that way over the whole church, whilst members are exhorted to be like that nevertheless toward one another. The main role of elders is to establish and to maintain the biblical standards and principles that all of us must seek to live under, and to bring the biblical instruction and counsel and guidance that all of us need for ongoing spiritual growth and help, and to be equipped to live for Christ and to serve His church. And within every church, there will always be practical needs. Practical needs of various sorts. And God in His Word instructs us to have men who can take the lead in overseeing such matters to ensure that the church is functioning in a helpful, in a spiritual, in an orderly way. Now, as with elders, it doesn't mean that the deacons are to be the only ones who are undertaking those tasks. Their role is to ensure that those tasks are being done and to have a helpful oversight over them. Well, let's take a look in a bit more detail on this issue of deacons serving in the church. Well, first of all, let's consider very simply what deacons are to be. Servants. The Greek word employed by Paul, as many of you know, is diakonos, which of course sounds very similar to deacon or diaconus as we call them, doesn't it? And it's a word which simply means servant. It isn't a title that's unique to the office of deacon. In fact, it's a word that's frequently used not as a title at all in that sense. It simply is describing one who is a servant. We find this word, diakonos, used in a variety of ways. Three main ways in the New Testament. The word speaks of servants in a very general sense. Those who may serve in any context, church or otherwise. Simply a servant. It's also used to speak of a spirit of servanthood or of ministry. That you yourself will humble yourself to have the heart of a servant towards others. You may not actually have a specific nameable role in the life of a particular church, but nevertheless, you have this servant heart and attitude towards others. And the word is used in that sense in the New Testament as well. Paul refers to himself, to Apollos, to Timothy as servants. Jesus says in Matthew chapter 20 that all believers are to be servants to each other. That's Matthew 20 verse 26. But then this word diakonos is also used to describe this specific office in the life of a church in which men serve alongside the elders in helping to lead and guide the local church. So we have it here in 1 Timothy 3. We have it, for example, in Paul's introduction to his letters to the Philippians. There he talks about the deacons. So the sense of this word is of one who ministers to someone else, one who ministers on behalf of another. It's to have a servant heart, a servant attitude. And that's to be seen in the life of a local church. It's a very simple point to begin with, but it's crucial to our understanding and to see and remember that all of us are called to serve. All of us are called to be servants, first of all, of Christ. In fact, of course, the Bible sometimes goes further than that. It actually calls us slaves to Christ, because we are actually owned by him. We are not our own anymore. We are to be slaves of Christ. Sometimes that word slave, doulos, bond slave, sometimes is just translated as servant, but a better translation would be slave. But all of us are called to serve as slaves of Christ. And even in our study of the elders, you remember how the Apostle Paul says that those who are elders and who are overseers are to serve as overseers. Even their overseeing is serving the church, and it's to be done as a servant to the church, not as an overlord over the church. So deacons are to serve, but we're all called to serve. Are you serving? Are you serving Christ? Are you serving his church? Are you doing it gladly? Are you doing it with a full heart? Called to serve. Well, let's ask ourselves another question. Compared to elders, what do deacons do? Can we be a bit more specific? Well, kind of, but at the same time, not that much, in a sense, because there's nothing really prescriptive laid down in the Bible about how to serve. Compared to the notes that we're able to put together regarding elders, we can come to some quite specifics about elders, and we went through that a fortnight ago. But those kinds of detailed specifics about the work of deacons is lacking in the scriptures in comparison. Now, certainly what many would do, and I think there's absolutely every reason to do so, is look at that example that's given to us in Acts chapter 6, when those seven men were called to be appointed in the church in Jerusalem to fulfill a very particular role because of a specific problem that had occurred. You read about it in the opening six verses of Acts chapter 6. And many would say that this is given to us as the first deacons being called and appointed and acknowledged and recognized within a local church. This practical help in the Jerusalem church, which was all about, if you like, providing a food bank, as we would call it today, for widows. That help, that work, was suffering some serious problems. There were a variety of ethnic and cultural groups within the church in Jerusalem, and sadly, they had rivalries amongst them. And those rivalries meant that some were being favoured over others in the allocation of bread. Cliques in churches, fancy that. Yes, even back then, in the Jerusalem church, all was not a bed of roses in the early church. Well, it was clear to the elders that it was necessary to appoint people to oversee and to manage this issue. So they encouraged and exhorted the church to consider seven suitable men who could be recognized by everybody else in the church as those who would supervise this operation. There was, therefore, a degree of authority which these men carried and which the other members must be ready to submit to. And what's important to remember is the spiritual character that these men were to have in order to be qualified to do this. Because even this was an issue of edification within the life of the church. And so you had to have mature, sober-minded, spiritual men so that it was performed in such a way that it brought all the members together rather than causing the division to become even worse and driving them apart from one another. So what can be said then is that deacons are to be set aside to ensure that the ministry of us all, the ministry of us all to one another, takes place in a way that is edifying and is orderly and is good before God and before a watching world. Now, does this mean that the deacons do all the ministering, do all the serving in the church? Well, no, of course not. We all do it. We all have a part to play in serving and ministering. Does it mean that a member needs the permission or sanction of a deacon in order to be able to carry out any form of service? Well, no, of course not. If you see a need that another has and you step in to meet that need, well, great, good, thank you. Praise God that you've taken that action. But maybe there's a need that no one else has noticed. Maybe there's some conflict in something that's being done. Maybe there's a lack of equity, as there was in Jerusalem. There's a lack of fairness in what's being done. Well, then we have deacons and they can step in. They can help to resolve that issue. They can help to restore things as they should be. And in those kinds of circumstances, the members ought to be ready to submit to them because they're there for the good of the church. This doesn't mean that the deacons make all the decisions. This doesn't mean that the deacons lay down the law as to how everything must be done. But they're there to help ensure that all is functioning well, that nothing's being missed. It may be that the elders in the church have seen that there's a very specific need that needs to be met, and so they'll ask a deacon or deacons to undertake that task for the good of the church. But as we considered with elders, even in all of this, the one another life of the church should always be encouraged. And as in Acts chapter 6, the whole church will often be included and sometimes consulted on these issues. The church chose these men. The church decided who these men would be, under whom we're all happy to submit and serve for our good. The elders and deacons are not to become some kind of executive committee riding shotgun over the church. That most definitely is not what is intended. Hopefully that has never come across in Belvedere Road Church. Deacons are crucial for the well-being of the church. But because it's the church we're talking about, the kind of men who are appointed, they must be men of mature and proven faith, just like elders. So who may serve as a deacon? Number three, who may serve as a deacon? Well, all of this, of course, comes out in the qualifications that are laid down in verses 3 to 8 of 1 Timothy 3, where it's immediately apparent when you read it straight after what's been said about elders that exactly the same kind of character should be sought in deacons as has already been laid down for elders. There's virtually no difference if you read those two things together. And Paul turns, you'll notice, from the topic of elders to deacons with the word likewise, or in the same way, because there's a lot of common ground here. The two lists aren't completely identical, but like identical twins, there's not an awful lot to distinguish between them. It's abundantly clear that, as we saw with elders, ability and capability once again take place to character. And probably just a few points worth highlighting without repeating too much what we've already said about elders. So if you have the passage open so that we can just have a look between the list for what is said about elders and what then is said about deacons? Well, first of all, deacons, verse 10, need to be men who've been tested. That's basically the same as saying not being a novice, as is said about elders in verse 6. They have a proven life and testimony inside the church and outside. Their home life, verse 12, is to be used as a measure of their suitability, just as it is for elders. Now, whilst being apt to teach is not a necessary qualification for deacons, which is for elders, and it's the one main point of difference between the two, although, of course, a deacon may teach, because they may well have the aptitude to teach, and of course they can, but they do have to be men who are in doctrinal agreement with all that the elders are going to be teaching, so that their ministry in the church is in line with all of those biblical truths that are coming from the pulpit and elsewhere, holding the mystery of the faith with a pure conscience. We're told that they must be found blameless, verse 10. Well, we're not setting out to try and find men who are perfect. That would prove to be a very long search. But men who have known no obvious or known faults or open sins, nothing that is known about them that would bring shame or dishonour to Christ or to his church, men of good, reliable, consistent reputation. That's what the word blameless means. These things being so, clearly, as with eldership, it is a spiritual service to the church. Although many of the things that the deacons may do may be more practical in nature, it still is a spiritual service to the church, which is why these qualifications are exactly the same as elders, because you're looking for exactly the same Christian character. It's all about character. And this character is everything that every Christian should be. These men just need to be mature, reliable, consistent, faithful Christians. Don't you want to be that? Don't we long for every member to be that? Of course we do. And verse 13 is simply saying that men who serve well in this office are worthy of respect in the church. And they'll also be a greater example and witness on account of their serving well. But even if you're not a deacon, even if you're never a deacon, ought not you also to be a good, faithful example in the life of the church? Doesn't Titus say in his letter that the younger ones, male or female, should be able to look up to the older ones and find in them a godly, Christ-like example who they can follow? So if you're one of the older ones or nudging in that direction, will you be such an example? Mustn't we all be? So these are the overriding things that are said about these offices in the church, and it's all about the godly character and nature of these who are to serve. But there's probably something that we do need to acknowledge. Now, I don't know if this applies to you, but for some, in many places, there is, as we sometimes say, an elephant in the room, for want of a better phrase. And the elephant in the room, as we look at this text, is the constant reference to men. I'm not going to avoid it. Now, maybe this is an issue for you. Maybe it isn't. But we need to think it through. And we need to consider what is actually being said here. The traditional view in the Church of Christ has been that this office, like that of an elder, because of the things that we're reading here and because of things that are said elsewhere, particularly through the teachings of the Apostle Paul, that these two offices in the church are only open to men. Now, over the last few decades, this has been challenged much more than it ever has before, especially in independent evangelical churches such as ourselves, and in some other denominations too. And many churches have started to change their policy on these things. Now, many have not gone so far as permitting women to serve as elders. But among many evangelical churches who've not taken that step, they do now permit women to hold the office of deacon, when once they did not. So we have to ask ourselves, what do we make of this? Well, first of all, it's interesting to ask of churches who have changed their position, what prompted you to change? Now, I've been curious about this for quite a number of years. I've actually put that question direct to pastors who pastor churches that have changed their policy. What prompted you to change? I think that's a very important and reasonable question to ask. And pastor to pastor, I can get away with it. You should be able to actually as well, but I certainly can. And so I've asked a few directly. Now, I've mentioned this before, but I think it's worth saying. Here's an answer I've never been given. "Well," said the pastor, "I was in my study one day and I was delving through these texts, and from my study of the Bible alone, I realized that after all of these years, I've had it wrong. And I've been misleading the church on this issue. I've misunderstood the Bible completely. And actually, I discovered through the Bible alone that it clearly does teach that there should be women serving as deacons." That's never been said. Nothing even close to that. I've never heard of any church where that's happened. Maybe you can point me in the direction of one. I don't know of one. What I have heard of is churches where, for whatever reason and from whatever source, be it from inside the church or outside the church, there's been pressure, there's been persuasion, there's been complaint, whatever, and that's been applied to the church leaders to get them to change their policy on this issue. And those leaders have decided that they will. And then they go back to the Bible in a way they never have before to see if they can find a way of justifying the appointment of women as deacons. And from that alternative exposition and interpretation of the Bible, their teaching and their position has changed. Well, if you can find me a church where that's not how it happened, well, please let me know. And of course, at the end of the day, the issue here is of bringing into the church what is going on in the unconverted world. And it really is as simple as that. So we have in this portion of 1 Timothy 3, being the husband of one wife and ruling over your household. Verse 2, verse 4, verse 12. This is speaking of a man. It can only be speaking of a man. Many like to try and argue that what we see in the New Testament is merely the product of their culture. It is merely the society of the day that they lived in. And it's reflected in the views that they had on these kinds of issues. Some would try to say, well, Paul is just using these terms to speak in a much more general way. Well, I don't think you can really read these passages and come to that conclusion. And of course, others would like to say much more strongly that this is just typical of the awful dominance of men over women. Well, how from the Bible do we address those kinds of things when they're said? Well, first of all, one passage which is really helpful in understanding the whole issue of spiritual headship of men, both in homes and in the church, is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 11. Because many would say, yeah, but that's just how it was in their day. It is just the culture they were in. They are just the norms of the society that they lived in, that they're bringing into the church. But when we read what Paul teaches in 1 Corinthians chapter 11, we simply cannot come to that conclusion at all. Because in 1 Corinthians chapter 11 at verse 3, Paul says, I want you to know that the head of every man is Christ. Please note where he begins. The head of every man is Christ. He's talking about men who are under Christ. That is crucial. The head of woman is man. The head of Christ is God. And then look at verse 7 and a few verses following. A man indeed ought not to cover his head, since he is the image and glory of God, but woman is the glory of man. We're not going to get into the issue of head coverings at this point. We'll leave that for another occasion. Verse 8, man is not from woman, woman from man. Nor was man created for the woman, but woman for the man. For this reason, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Nevertheless, neither is man independent of woman, nor woman independent of man in the Lord. So you see, the Apostle Paul doesn't allow us for one moment to suggest that these things that are being taught in 1 Timothy 3 are merely the result of culture or society. He takes us all the way back to creation. He says, no, this is how God created us. This is the source of it. This is how God created us to be. This is how God intends this world in which we live to be. This is the relationship between men and women under Christ that God created us for. It's not bound up in culture. It's God's creation order. And look at the end of chapter 2, going back to 1 Timothy. Because at the end of 1 Timothy chapter 2, Paul has actually been addressing women. Let's read from verse 8. I desire, therefore, that the men pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting. In like manner also, that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel with propriety and moderation, not with braided hair or gold or pearls or costly clothing, but which is proper for women professing godliness with good works. Let a woman learn in silence with all submission. I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. Here he goes again. This is just male dominance. This is just culture. This is just the male-dominated society. No. For, verse 13 begins, for, because Adam was formed first, then Eve. And as Paul gives those instructions, what does he do? He takes us right back to creation. He takes us right back to the way God designed the world that he has created. And he says the source and the origin of it is there, and the source and the origin of this is God. Because this is how God has made the world to be. This is how God made us to be. But remember again, when you read those verses, but then turn to a passage such as Ephesians chapter 5, where God lays down through his apostle what is expected of husbands, you'll see that it's a million miles away from the misogynistic, downtreading suppression of women that some try to make it out to be. Husbands, Ephesians 5:25. Love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. You will not find a higher bar set for love than that. Men, don't you dare love your wives any less than Christ's love for the church. That's the bar that's set for men. It's as high as it possibly could be. Husbands, verse 28, love their own wives as their own bodies. The bar is set so very, very high. And there's a great mystery, as Paul continues, of husband and wife becoming one flesh. It's a glorious thing. It's a glorious truth. This mystical relationship between husband and wife as the two become one, and yet the husband under Christ, before God, assuming responsibility for that household that he's over. And this is God's way for his people. That actually is God's way for all people, because it's for all of creation. Marriage is for all of creation. Those kinds of relationships apply for everybody, whether you're a Christian or you're not. But if you are a Christian, how could we not take them on board, and how could we not consider them? And so this issue that Paul raises about men, we discover that it has this creation foundation. And so what Paul teaches in those scriptures that we've just read about the nature of husband and wife in the home, that is the basis of verse 2. That is the basis of verse 4. That is the basis of verse 12 in 1 Timothy 3. Paul is saying those things in 1 Timothy 3 because he understands the whole foundation upon which this rests, which is from God, from creation. Paul knows that it's the role of the husband to take responsibility under Christ, before God, for those things in the home. And that is to be transferred across into the church family as well. Which is why he says, if this man ain't up to scratch in the home, for goodness sake, don't appoint him in the church. Do you want to live a life that pleases God? You must live your life according to the pattern that God intends. And any Christian who wants to try and somehow reinterpret all of this, well, I'm sorry, but you're meddling with truths which are not yours to meddle with. This is how God has instituted life and relationships in his world that he's made. We also recognize in the Bible that whenever Paul, as an example, intends to address women, he actually makes it clear that he's specifically addressing women. As in Ephesians chapter 5, where we've just read from, where a few verses earlier, he specifically addresses wives. And he makes it clear, I'm talking to you women now, wives. It's clear, it's obvious, plain. Then he turns to husbands, and it's plain, it's clear, it's obvious. Likewise here in 1 Timothy. He has something to say to women specifically towards the end of chapter 2. So he says in verse 9, in like manner also that the women. Right, I'm talking to you women now, says Paul. It's clear, it's obvious. He doesn't expect the men to have issues of braiding their hair or gold or pearls. He's talking to women, but he tells us he's talking to women. You women. He makes it clear. And then as he begins verse 1 of chapter 3, he makes it clear he's now talking about men. If a man. So Paul is very helpful. If he's addressing the whole church, it's obvious he's addressing the whole church. If he wants to address one individual, he makes it clear that he's addressing one individual. If he's addressing men, it's obvious he's addressing men. If he's talking to women, it's clear that he's talking to women. The Bible is very unambiguous in this regard. And so as he moves into the topic of elders at the beginning of chapter 3, he's now addressing men. If a man desires the position of a bishop, and everything else he says is from the perspective of a man. Now, when he's talking about deacons, as we get to verses 10 and 11 and 12, for example, in verse 10, he's talking about deacons and the qualifications for them. Then he says, likewise, their wives must be reverent, not slanderers, temperate, faithful in all things. Now, some try to suggest that at that point there, in verse 11, Paul is talking to women deacons. Well, why use the word likewise there if he hasn't changed topic? Paul uses the word likewise when he changes topic. Why somehow try to differentiate between male deacons and female deacons? The qualifications for a deacon are laid out. In verse 8, he's moving from the topic of elders to the topic of deacons, so he uses the word likewise. In verse 11, he moves from the subject of deacons to their wives. So again, he uses the word likewise. And it's not at all unreasonable to require that these men should have like-minded wives, that they should have wives of similar character. Male deacons involved in practical ministry may well include their wives in various aspects of their work. That would seem both natural, good, wise, and completely acceptable. But the wife needs to understand the responsibilities that she'll be under when she assists her husband in that way. Their wives are going to have some knowledge of the things that their husband is involved in as a deacon. And so on that basis, Paul inserts this short instruction regarding their wives. It seems completely sensible. It seems completely reasonable, particularly with regard to keeping confidences and not gossiping about what's being done. So he says for the men, they're not to be double-tongued. That's in verse 8. Saying one thing, but doing another. Don't be double-tongued. And their wives, not to be slanderers, which means not to be a malicious gossip. And it seems to me that those two traits fit perfectly well together. And so, from elders, likewise, deacons. From deacons to wives, likewise, their wives. And then verse 12, he goes back to the deacons. Let deacons. And he's back again, talking about deacons. So he's made it clear now that he's stopped talking about their wives and now he's addressing the deacons again. And when you read it through, it's very clear. And to try and read these verses any other way is most perverse. And it will only serve to tie you up in knots spiritually and in your understanding of the Bible. If Acts 6:1-6 is to be taken as an account of the first appointment of deacons, as many do assert and seems very reasonable to me, it can't be overlooked that the elders specifically instruct that men be appointed. And as we've seen, you can't suggest that that is just cultural or societal. It goes back to creation. But as I said when we were looking at Paul's closing remarks in the final 16th chapter of Romans when we were doing our study through Romans. In all of these things, it's the serving that's the key thing. Not being the holder of a particular office or title. It's the serving that's important. All of us are to be servants and are to serve. The church is to be a family of one another as we serve each other. There'll be plenty of men as well as women who never serve as an elder or deacon. But you must never equate that to meaning that any service they do or offer is somehow second rate or second best compared to someone who has this title. No, not at all. I don't take the beginning of Romans 16 where Paul talks about Phoebe to mean that she was a deacon in the sense of holding an office, but she was a servant, as we all should be. And what esteem she is held in by Paul, and rightly so. She's a faithful servant. That's what all of us are called to be in Christ's church, faithful servants. And she has a vital place and function within Christ's church. In fact, when you read through the scriptures, you read and you discover there is to be no Christian who does not have a vital place or function within Christ's church. We are all members together of the body with all kinds of different functions between us, but all absolutely crucial if the church is to be healthy and vibrant. And these verses, whilst providing crucial teaching on these two offices within the church, must also be seen as a word of exhortation for every Christian believer. This is the standard of character that Christ is looking for in every single one of us. This is the standard of character that the Holy Spirit produces in everyone who turns to Christ. What kind of Christian you are is so much more important than holding or having a certain office or title. What kind of Christian are you? That's a far greater consequence. And we do well to remember the lessons we've just been learning on Sunday mornings in Matthew 18 about what true greatness is in God's kingdom. True greatness is not about having a title before your name in the church. True greatness, Jesus said, is being as a little child before your heavenly Father. And that's even true for elders, even true for deacons, we could say, even more so. Just children before their Father, totally dependent upon Him, leading the way in that regard, being an example to all. This is what it means to be a little child before your heavenly Father. In these scriptures, we find the pattern for godly, Christ-like homes and churches. In hearing these things and doing them, we will be most happy and blessed and united and peaceful and obedient and faithful. And in this, God will be pleased. God will be glorified. God will pour out His blessing upon His people when we're faithful and obedient to His word. Well, may we be greatly helped as we've considered these things. But above all, if you want to take home one thing this evening, take home this. All of us under Christ are being called to serve. Every single one of us. To serve Him. To serve His people. For our edification and for His glory and praise. Well, may He help all of us to do that together in this local church.